This is Ken Back, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 1st of August 2011. Ken Back, Part 1.
Full name is Eric Kenneth Prentice Back, and the date of birth is 23/2/42.
And where were you born, Ken?
In Southport, Lancashire.
Was that Prentice, did you say?
Prentice, yes.
Where does that come from?
It's a Lowlands of Scotland, Lanarkshire name.
So that suggests your parents are of the Scottish persuasion, does it?
Yes, it does, I'm afraid. Yeah. My mother was Scot and my father was English.
What did your father do?
He was in the Navy and he never really approved of my going south. And a lot of muttering at the time. And my mother, it was a shock for my mother too, I think. They were born in Chile, and that's why the Antarctic had an appeal for me. The southern hemisphere, the southern part of America, has always been of interest.
So your parents were born in Chile?
My mother was born in Chile, sorry. My mother was born in Chile, and Dad was on HMS Exeter between the wars, and life was fairly social in those days, and they had a dance at my mother's house, and he ran off with her, took her back to England.
But she was Scottish, not Chilean?
Yes, yes. It's Chilean nationality, but of Scots blood.
Right. Mm. And by sheer coincidence, we're recording this interview in Exeter.
Yes, indeed.
The name of your father's
ship. Yes, the father's ship. Yes, yes.
Would you say you had a... What sort of education did he have? Was it extensive?
Yes, the usual. I went to prep school at the age of 8 and Radley at the age of 13 and Durham University in 1960 at the age of 18.
Did you read classics? Is that right?
Yes, I did, yes. That raised a few eyebrows with Bath.
How do you mean?
At my interview. It's funny to go back to the interviews of those days. It's so different from now. But it was Bill Sloman and Eric Salmon. And Bill Sloman, very dry, said, "I see you've done a bit of Latin. We need Met Man down there." And that's how that's all the interview was, really. It really didn't consist of very much more.
And that led to your nickname, of course, didn't it?
Which one?
There's more than one, is there? Well, I was thinking of Bacchus.
Bacchus, yes, that's right, yes.
Because of the name and the classics. Were there other nicknames?
There were, yes. Bacchus wasn't widely used. It never became vogue. For my first 2 years at Adelaide, I was called Hasty, because of the Scott song, what is it, "Will Ye Hasty Back Again" or something. But we had a lot of Scotsmen on bass in 1964, and that was my name for the duration.
So that was your FIDS nickname?
Hasty, yes.
Yeah. What was your first awareness that a place called the Antarctic actually existed?
A bad move, this. I read Roger Banks's book, The Unrelenting Ice. And I brought this up at interview, and it didn't go down well at all. One of the interviewers, Eric Salmon, was one of Roger Banks's winterers and didn't like the guy and obviously didn't get on with him. And it very nearly cost me the job, I think.
Were you able to talk him round?
I think Bill Sloman did. I got on a lot better with Bill Sloman than with Eric.
Yeah. And what made you want to apply to go to the Antarctic?
Absolute luck. And I was at university, and Bill and Eric came up to do a recruiting drive.
The milk round.
A milk round, yes, yes. But they only spoke to the scientists. And I was completely unaware that they were around. And a geologist friend of mine at Durham passed the message on and more or less bet me that I wouldn't apply. And he thought it would be suitable for me. And I did. And a month or two went by and I heard nothing and had written it off, really. I was going into British Rail. That was my key job application. And after a long time, after a month and a half, I think, there was a brown papered envelope in the post, and they said I could go to Adelaide Island.
But what made you want to apply, Ken?
Oh, that's quite tricky, yes. There's quite a lot of exploration in the genes, I think.
Go on.
One of my ancestors was Sir George Back, the Arctic explorer. And the first doctor at Port La Croix during the war was Eric Back. And I think this didn't have a direct bearing, but I think there's something in the genes, I think.
So what relation were you to Eric?
Eric was a third cousin. Not close at all.
Did you know him at all?
Yes, I did know him, yes.
What sort of man was he?
He was an excellent chap. He was a paediatrician by trade in later life. That's when I met him. I didn't know him that well to be able to say what he would have been like on base. Mm-hmm. I believe from the reports he was very good.
What would you say he was the exploring type?
No, I don't think so. I think he was. He got along well with people. I think that was his forte. But having said that, he came back for more than one winter. So he probably had the exploration in him. But that wasn't the impression he gave, no.
And did he encourage you? Was he around to encourage you to do
this? No, not at all. No, I met him after I'd gone with Bass for the first time. When I came back, I met Eric, and he had no bearing on my going at all. And I happened to mention at interview that I was distantly related to him, and it probably didn't come amiss.
Do you know why they took you on? Because I'm not aware of any meteorological training you'd had previously.
No, I had no meteorological training. In those days, it was possible to go down without any. They did take men without training. Now it would be unthinkable. Absolutely. Totally unthinkable.
So why do you think Bass took you on then?
I have no idea at all. Why I was more qualified than the other applicants, I have no idea at all. They may have seen potential BC material for later on. I don't know. I have no idea.
And did you have an amateur interest in the weather?
Yes.
Over and above the average Englishman's interest?
Yes, certainly, yes.
You
yes,
did?
Yes.
Do you know where that came from? Is that more in the genes?
No, I can't say,
right.
No.
Okay.
It was...
In those days, did you actually apply to go to a particular base, or were you just accepted and then detailed to go somewhere?
Accepted. To start with, one was accepted and then detailed later on.
And would you say the interview was thorough, or was it a bit of an old boys?
Very much an old boys thing.
Thing, yeah.
Yes. Absolutely remarkable by today's standards.
So did you feel you went in knowing you got the job, or was it...?
No, I went in thinking that I hadn't got the job, because I defended Eric Salmon for a start.
Mm. What did he have to do in that period between being told he had the job and setting sail?
It was very busy. We did a 2-month Met training course at Stanmore at the Met, what was the Met Office Training School, and then a month's practical at an airport. I went to Prestwick Airport and did a month there.
Did you take to it?
Yes, very much. Yes, particularly Prestwick. I enjoyed the course. It was a good laugh, and I think I learned something. But Prestwick was particularly good, and I met another Antarctic Met man there, Andrew Blackie, who was I'd done with the IGY in 1957 at Halley, and so he was excellent as one of the trainers there, and the staff generally at Prestwick were very helpful, I thought, and I learned much more there than I did on the Met course.
And was there any other kind of training, like survival training or health and safety? Or
no, absolutely none at all, which again is remarkable by today's standards. I couldn't ski, and that didn't count against at all. And I was going to a static job at a static base, and there was no outdoor qualification, no.
You were just going to be in your hut 24 hours a day, were you?
I think that was the idea, yes, yes.
How did he get south?
An amazing trip on the Biscoe, 4 months from Southampton to Adelaide. And we got beset in the ice off Argentine Islands, after leaving Argentine Islands, way out in the Pacific somewhere. We were beset for 2 months. And during that time, the wintering teams formed a unit on the ship, and I think this is something very valuable that's forgotten today, that by the time we eventually reached base we were a well-knit team, and I think that's terribly important, and that's something that's just lost in today's fly-in fly-out commuter science. Nobody settles down at all, and the trip itself was very enjoyable. We did the round of all the bases except Halley, and with very bad ice conditions, and it was absolutely fascinating. Yes.
Do you remember any what the feeling was when you were stuck in the ice for 2 months? You were trying to get to base, and it must be frustrating, surely.
Morale was good. It was frustrating, yes. And some people were more frustrated than others, but the morale was good, I must say. And I don't know if you remember the old Biscoe, but the fiddery was very small, and just surviving under those conditions was a very good preparation for base, and the appalling overcrowding. But being stuck in the ice per se wasn't a bad morale thing at all. No, I think.
Can you recall what you did to pass those 2 months?
I was never bored, I must say. Just looking at the beautiful scenery, that was a major thing for everybody. And it's absolutely gone out of my head what we did, but the time passed, I must say.
When you got within spitting distance of the Antarctic, did it fulfil your expectations? What was it like for you?
Yes, it was very dramatic. We were 100 miles northwest of Adelaide at the time, and towards sunset, I think it was, we saw the mountains on the horizon, and lifted up above the horizon, and very much as Biscoe first saw them in 1831,
32. Mm. Did you feel connected to the heroic age? I mean, you were still on the very tail end of the heroic
period. Very, very tail end. And I did. Yes, we felt we were connected. I think everybody had that feeling of connection to the heroic age. Yes.
How was that feeling? responsibility? Did you have a responsibility to your predecessors?
I think we were more... Yes, I think we felt we had to live up to something. Yes, I think so. I think rather than the distant heroic age, the more immediate mentors were the British Gremlin expedition. I think that was these guys were the ideal for us of, in Marguerite Bay, of the people to look up to. Who did things. Unlike the heroic age, they brought in their Arctic training as well. I'd say that the average time for the trip in the early 1960s was 2 months, and even that was a good cementing trip for the future winterers. And the fact that we had four was an added bonus. And in fact, Stonington and Adelaide both had good, happy winters that year.
Tell me what met your eyes when you arrived at Adelaide in 1964?
64, February, March 64 it was.
What was it like in those days?
We had an amazing trip in. I was just going to say that we eventually went in by the ice cliffs at the northwest corner of Adelaide Island. A route was found by the GAs through the crevasses, the coastal crevasses, and we went up to high ground to where the plane could land and were ferried by aircraft to Base T. And I think my first impressions were very favourable there. It's called Black Adelaide, it was a nice summer day, and I didn't. It wasn't a come down at all. I felt this is it, and it was. I felt I would be fine there for 2 years. And
there were quite a few of you, weren't there?
Yes, there were indeed, and because the ship didn't initially get to Stonington, and so we had Stonington and Adelaide wintering together for the first month or two. Until the ice froze, that they could travel to Stonington.
Were there more men than bunks?
It was close. We had all the huts at Adelaide were occupied, and the old bunk room at Adelaide was a real black hole. Actually, it was to be bunks of three. I think it took 18, and 18 in the bunk room and the rest scattered around.
Well, there's mention in the logs of trying to create air conditioning conditions inside the hut. What do you remember of that?
It was totally airless, yes. Particularly in later winter when the snow piled up and it was the windows were all sealed. And it was a problem, I think, the air conditioning in the bunk room. I'm not sure if we ever got round that. I didn't think we did.
The stories about inserting two fans in there. Do you remember that bit?
No, I don't actually. No, that's completely gone. I don't think they were in there for very long.
And there was quite a bit of problem with the supplying process that winter.
Yes,
because the conditions were against you. What do you remember of that?
There wasn't for Adelaide. We had a full supply of food and fuel, as far as I remember. Fuel may have been a bit short, but there was plenty of food. Stonington was much harder hit. They couldn't get all the stuff into Stonington. The ship did eventually get to Stonington much later in March, but it had to beat a hasty retreat for the weather, and they didn't get what they wanted to get ashore.
Did you have your own meteorological office as such?
In those days, it was a separate hut on the top of the hill. The base nestled at the foot of the hill, and the Met hut involved a 100-foot scramble up a rope. And that was the Met office. Yes, it was an individual Met office in those days, and I loved it. It was a way one got away from base, and it was a nice change of scene, and a very good weather situation for a weather station too.
Well, walk me around what you remember of it. What was it like inside?
It was half the size of this room.
So half the size of a lounge.
Less than half, and he went through the door. And the Met desk was on the wall opposite, and on the left hand side, hidden by the door, was a bunk room. So we did night Met there, and it was considered safer at the time to spend the night up there rather than to commute up and down the rope during the middle of the night.
So there was one bunk, was there?
One bunk, yes, one top bunk. There was a bottom bunk. It was used for stores.
What was it like then to be alone in the world in the Antarctic, in that hut at night?
It didn't mean anything really. It was just normal, and it was quite eerie, yes, to start with, I think. But we soon got used to it, and when the wind shook, it was quite, you couldn't sleep at all. It was absolutely no chance of sleeping. It was quite very noisy, and it shook like hell. Yes, happy memories. Yes, I was very upset to hear that it was removed by Steve Wormald, actually, in the early 70s.
There's mention in the logs of a thing called the Avian Line. Does that ring any bells for you? That wasn't the ropeway between the two huts, was it?
I've never heard it called that.
No.
Where did you find that out?
In the log books.
Gosh.
Talk of the Avian Line, but that may have been a surveying line, because your colleagues were doing some survey work, weren't they?
Yes, they were indeed, yes.
Did he ever go out on that?
Yes, I did. I camped on the Morris Four Islands in the middle of Marguerite Bay for a month. Well, this was the Naval Hydrographic Survey in 64-65. I think it would have been, or possibly 65, 66. But that, yes, most enjoyable. And I spent quite a lot of time with that, and it involved taking a trig, maybe putting a yes, we went up to the top of Lagatellery Island, where the most southerly grass grows in the Antarctic. That was a good jolly to put a trig point on the top of Lagatellery Island. That was also with the hydrographic survey. I don't remember the Avian Line though, and I think that was probably the base surveyors.
Well, let me quote you from the base report for 1964, written by W. Geddes.
Yeah.
Dick, Bill and Jim took a stroll over to Avian before lunch. No seal sighted. And the next day, Big Jim and Bill took their morning constitutional walk to Avian. They met Bacchus, the conscientious Met man, halfway to Avian. And when asked why he was out on the sea ice when he should have been on Met, he answered, "I was just checking the cloud base against the mountains around this side of the island. We've a right one here."
Oh, no, does that ring any bells? No, it doesn't. No, I completely forgotten that. But it, Yes, it sounds very reasonable. Yeah.
It also talks about you doing some tobogganing.
Yes.
You couldn't ski.
This was the following winter, I think, in 1965, the tobogganing year.
All right.
I think.
Go on.
And we had midwinter toboggan races, and I think the doc put a stop to them in the end because they were too dangerous. it was the Piedmont slope where it comes down to base was very icy at the time, and there were some near misses.
Was the football also dangerous?
Yes, depending on how icy it was, it certainly was. Yes. The doctor, another doctor, frowned on that. Yes.
You were playing Marguerite Bay, I might gather.
Yes. Yes. I don't remember it, though.
Okay. where are we? I'm just trying to jog your memory. Mm. Midwinter matches between the Adelaide Aristocrats and the Marguerite Bay Monarchs. Would you have played in that?
I think everyone would have been roped in, yes. And, of course, we had the... this is 64, isn't it? We had the Stonington people on base then.
Mm.
So they were that's where they came in. I don't remember that at all, actually. Yeah.
All right. Tell me a little bit then about the met work you did and what your routine was like, Ken.
We did 3 hourly observations around the clock, and kept an eye on the weather in the interim time. The shift work in those days was one day on. And 3 days off, something like that. And then in later years it became a week on and a week off, or 2 weeks off. Yes, we did one day on and then three days off it was, yes.
And were you doing standard observations, or were you doing anything unusual?
Just standard observations, yes. And we had balloon making balloon filling equipment there. We made our own hydrogen and could send up a balloon more or less when we wanted to. It wasn't a fixed routine at all.
How did you follow the balloon's progress?
Through a theodolite. A little theodolite. The balloon hut was next to the met hut on top of the hill. And we just tracked the balloon through the theodolite.
Some of the stations have had huts with ceiling or roof doors for the balloon to go up. Do you remember that in your case, or was it wood? How did you launch the balloons?
Yes, through the roof. Yes, yes. Just
so you had a protected environment to inflate the balloon.
It was our balloon shed was very small. It was tiny, and it was almost easier to take the balloon out to let it go. And to risk it snagging on the edge of the shed. It wasn't a big feature at Adelaide. Any balloons were a bonus. We didn't have to do them at all. But they were appreciated in Stanley by the forecasters there.
So you're radioing the results back to Stanley?
Yes.
By Morse, I presume?
Yes. Yes, everything was in Morse when there were teleprinters when I started even.
And was this primarily for pilots?
It was for climatological data around the world. I think from Stanley they were put on the international circuit, and particularly for Cape Town, Melbourne. And they're the principal users of our data, and presumably Buenos Aires and Santiago also. I never knew where the observations eventually ended up, actually, but they went into the system, into the international system.
I know you had some strange weather in your second spell at Adelaide, but were there any unusual weather conditions or exceptional weather conditions?
Yes, one of the reasons Adelaide was so fascinating as a weather station was the unusual nature of the weather.
What do you recall?
The the most obvious thing was the beautiful clouds, the nacreous clouds and noctilucent clouds. They were particularly attractive, and after usually in the middle of a very bad spell of weather and a filthy night, and you'd wake up in the morning and see these things, and absolutely wonderful. We didn't have aurora at Adelaide. It was not once, I think, or maybe once, but very faint. We were out of the aurora zone. We had tremendous northerly gales, and they were always interesting, always kept us on our toes. But they were always warm gales. They weren't like the filthy cold gales elsewhere. So they were no real hardship.
Do you remember the weather being random, or was there some sort of rhythm to it?
There was a rhythm, yes. It was basically easterly, northeasterly weather, with very rare winds from the opposite direction, southwest, southwest, were very rare.
And they were cold, I presume.
Yes, they were. It was strange to have to be in a location with a beautiful, clear seaward horizon, but no wind from that direction. A very, very odd sensation, yes. We got northwesterly. That was a good. That was the nearest we got to an onshore wind.
What other standout memories do you have from that first couple of years south?
Very happy ones. It was a very good time, particularly the first winter, 64. We had a wonderful gang of four climbers from Scotland, who were, of course, nicknamed the Craig Dhu, including Johnny Cunningham, the base commander. And I think John ran a very good show, and he was never on base. They were always away climbing. And they were great characters.
Did they bring any home habits south with them?
Yes, they certainly did, I think, yes.
Can you elaborate?
they weren't hard drinkers. They liked a dram every now and then. They particularly liked sitting in the bar and yakking. They were good at that. They weren't heavy drinkers. In fact, John and one of the others hardly drank at all.
Fisticuffs?
Oh, gosh. Yes, I think there were. But as far as I remember, it was good humour. I don't think there was any acrimony.
There's a note here.
Was that David Todd, was that, I think?
I've got a note from Dog Holden.
Yeah?
Who says that Ken said that in order to maintain the Craig Dhu tradition of fighting rivals when at home, they fought amongst themselves just out of habit.
Yeah.
That's from your first winter.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
I think there's a bit of slight license there. Yes. They didn't fight as they would have done back home, but they had good arguments, I think. But a lively crowd, a very, very enjoyable company.
One of your responsibilities was to look after the tool workshop, is that right?
Oh, yes, yes.
How did they get lumbered with that?
Oh, yes, I think that was rather a mismatch, actually. I had no experience of woodworking or carpentry at all. And we had some excellent craftsmen on base. And I never agreed with John Cunningham for giving me that. There would have been other things much more suitable.
What did he have to do?
I just had to make sure that it was tidy and orderly. It didn't actually involve very much, and later in the year to do the indent and unpack all the stores, the cargo, the incoming cargo, and the inventory, do the inventory and the indent later in the year. Those were the only two things, but I didn't think my heart was in it.
Did you manage to get any flying done that first trip?
My flying was mainly later in the second trip, I think.
Well, we'll come to that in a moment.
Yes.
You did your 2 years at Adelaide.
Yes, I did do flying, yes. In the following summer, yes, we, indeed. Yes, I. Curiously enough, the co-pilot's job was never much in demand at Adelaide, and there was always a vacancy for anyone who enjoyed doing it.
Do you remember any particular flights? I appreciate we're talking about 50 years ago.
Yes. Fossil Bluff was nothing memorable there. It was just the most enjoyable, jolly flying over the Marguerite Bay, all frozen. And then I went to Stonington. I remember taking off in a gale at Stonington, and, which was pretty hair-raising. It was we got airborne in about 200 yards. but no particular memories of we had an RAF pilot the first year, Ted Skinner, and Bill Mills was a Canadian, and he was the one who wrecked the Twin Otter on the ice cliff that remained on the ice cliff at Adelaide for many years.
During your time, or...?
Yes, it was during our relief.
What do you remember of that incident?
Yes, it was a shock, and he just misjudged it. They were flying around the clock, he was overtired, and in very bad light, and just misjudged the landing.
And what happened?
The plane was a write-off, flying a heavy load of cargo, and he came in to land and just went off on one side.
How do you mean, Ken? Did you see it happen?
No, I didn't. No.
You saw the aftermath?
Yes.
So the plane flipped over, did it?
Flipped over, yes. And it didn't flip over, actually. It was a heavy landing. The skis were written off, and it couldn't get airborne.
How was the pilot?
Fine, yes, he wasn't injured at all.
Just embarrassed.
Yes, indeed, yeah, extremely.
So you did 2 years in Adelaide in the mid-60s, and then you left again, you came home.
No, I didn't. I went to South Georgia straight away on the ship. They were one met man short in South Georgia. When I was on the Biscoe, due to go back, and already started going back, on my way home, and the captain of the Biscoe said that they're one met man short in South Georgia due to an accident, and are there any volunteers? And I was the only volunteer. So.
So you weren't ready to come home then?
No, I was quite happy. I went to South Georgia for that winter.
Just one winter?
Yes, a short winter.
How did that compare to Adelaide?
At the time, I felt it was quite decadent.
Decadent?
Yes. Because it was the colonial government in those days, with the colonial hierarchy and magistrate and policeman, customs officer and everything. There was very little in the way of work ethic there. There was a lot of drinking. I enjoyed it. It was, for me, a wonderful experience.
This would be 1966.
66, yes. Yeah. But it wasn't... it was so different from the Fiji experience where everybody mucks in to do everything, or did in those days. You didn't really go out of your way to help anyone else unless he asked for your help.
Where would you say that the differences stemmed from? Is it because it was a different organisation?
Yes, I think so. Yeah. Yes, they didn't have the inheritance of the heroic age. I think that's what it comes to.
Was the network very different?
It was quite different. I was working for somebody then. I was working for the senior Met officer. It was Danny Borland, who was a fine South Georgia character. But he was quite eccentric, and it wasn't easy. He kept all his gramophone records in the bath.
In the bath?
Yes. And there was one other Met man there, one other assistant, Dave Wheeler, who now lives on Fair Isle. And we were at Danny's beck and call, basically, and it was different from Adelaide in that at Adelaide I felt at home and I could spend time in the Met hut when I, apart from just doing the observations, but Danny occupied the Met office in South Georgia and did forecasts and everything, very good forecasts he did, and was always listening to the Morse to try and get the South American Met stations, and the crackling, it was terrible. And as well as that, he had the gramophone on with music. So what with the music and the crackling, it was a bit of a nightmare in there. And the same observations. There was a balloon shed, but Danny appreciated it when we did balloons, but he didn't enforce them. In fact, the weather played a big part, and most of the time it was out of the question.
Well, the weather conditions were quite different, I think, at St. George, weren't they? The overriding weather
patterns. Yes, totally, totally different. Yes, absolutely.
In what way?
At Adelaide, you really had the feeling that you were on a maritime station. We had the swell at Adelaide as well as the wind, and it was a dynamic place. South Georgia it's calm most of the time. If you send up a balloon at South Georgia, it spirals around for 3,000 feet and then shoots off. And it was like, yes, it was very, very sheltered compared with Adelaide.
So let's then come to this decision to come home again, which was a year later than I thought, but nevertheless. Yes. You did your year at South Georgia.
Yes.
And then what brought you, did he come back to Britain?
Yes, I went to South America first, though. I had a South American jolly before I got home. I didn't get home till about May 67, I think it was.
So you've missed the World Cup final.
Yes. Yes. And
what did you do with yourself when you got back to Britain?
It was strange. I didn't have to work at headquarters at all, so I was signed off, basically. And I didn't hang around for long, actually. I did get another job in Canada. I was home in May and got a job in Canada in August.
Doing what, Ken?
That was at the McGill Subarctic Research Laboratory in Shefferville in northern Quebec, 700 miles north of Montreal. And a very similar sort of the nearest thing to Arctic FIDS, I suppose.
So you were in the icy wastes again, were you? But
yes, I went straight up to... I was only in England for Well, for a 3 months of summer, really. May, June, July, and a bit of August. And then I caught the ship to Montreal and had an enjoyable time with the boss, Professor Baird, at McGill University, and a weekend at his retreat in Quebec, and then flew up to Montreal, to Sheffield.
And what was your duty there?
I was a Met man, a Met again. Observer, again. Oh. Very different, doing aircraft weather there for regular planes and as well as climatological. And the Canadian aircraft weather is completely different to ours.
Did you spot any significant differences between the Canadian outfit and Bass? The way they were run and so on?
Hello?
Yes, they were... the Canadian outfit had a permanent director and his wife there. And that was, I think, the main difference. They lived there all the time. And they weren't quite as hands-on as the base commander in down south. It's quite different when the chap's living as one of you to if he's living in his own apartment. So I think it worked well, but it was different.
Did that account for all your time between being south and being south again? Because you went back to...
Yes, I did 2 winters up north. Winter 67, 68, and then Bill Sloman contacted me again, saying that he wanted someone to be BC at Sydney. So we now I spent all the time in Canada up till September 1969, as far as I remember. And then a quick briefing, and we went down in November.
So when did you go to Sydney? In November?
November 69.
Right.
I'm absolutely wrong, sorry. I went back to Adelaide for another 2 years. Is that what you've got there? Yeah.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry. Okay. No, I went back to Adelaide in November 69 for the winters of 1966 and 67. Oh, gosh.
The late 60s, you were in Canada, and then you went to Sydney.
70 and 71. Yeah.
And it was... Sorry, you went to Adelaide, 70, yeah. 71. You went back as base commander to Adelaide.
Yes, not as BC, just as a Met observer.
Right, okay.
Bill Sloman wanted me to go as base commander.
Do you know why he wanted you to go? Did he explain why... Why it had to be Ken Back?
He said that there was nobody else suitable, and I was reluctant at the time. I felt I couldn't manage it, and with retrospect, I think that was right. We had some difficult characters in 1917.
What was making you reluctant to go back? Because you did. You went in the end for 2 more years to Adelaide.
Yes.
But what was your reservation?
There was no reluctance at all to go down as a Met man. It was the responsibility of base commander that I was reluctant.
Later
by.
On.
For 70 and 71. Bill Sloman tried to get me to be base commander.
Right. So you were asked to be a base commander, but you agreed only to be a Met man.
Yes.
I understand. And the reluctance to be a base commander? Well, what was that?
I just felt that I couldn't handle the responsibility.
You had some very, very unusual weather. You were senior Met man when you went back to
Yes.
To Adelaide, and you had some very unusual exceptional weather, I believe.
Ah, in 1970.
71. Extremely good weather. The warmest weather in 10 years.
Yes, yes. Yes, yes, it was. For me, that's not a particularly significant thing. I prefer the stormy years with a big difference in temperature.
Do you have any idea why the weather was so? Did you ever work out why the weather was so genial?
No. No, there were other flat years, I call them. 1965 was another warm year, and then there was 1971, wasn't it? 1970. Yeah. I think, in retrospect, I suspect it was the start of global warming.
Right. But nobody spotted it. I'll rephrase that question.
Yes, we did.
You did?
Yes, we did spot it, and we felt it was getting... From 1970... Even from 1965 onwards, the winters were getting milder, the sea ice worse, and I think we had an inkling that something was happening.
So how did you interpret that? Did you come to the conclusion, when you say you spotted global warming, did you know what it was at the time?
No.
Right.
No, so we had no idea. Just realised
it was getting warmer.
Yes, that global warming is at its most extreme off the peninsula, in the area of the Antarctic Peninsula.
Today, yes.
Yes, and I think it was the beginning of the trend, I suspect. But from the Met observations, no inkling.
One note I've got here is that... you had a 74-hour burn from the sun over Christmas.
And goodness.
There was several references to how tranquil the weather was.
Gosh, in the summer of...
Southern summer of 71, yeah.
Right,
the
yes.
The winter party was very disappointed that the conditions weren't more extreme.
Yes, indeed, yes. I think everything functions better when they are a bit more extreme, actually. Yes.
I'm dotting about a bit, but it doesn't matter.
No.
I just want to get some key points from you, really.
Yeah.
Part of your duty, part of the duty of the base was to try and record the depths of snow around Adelaide in that second spell that you were there. Is that right?
Yes, I took snow stakes down for that purpose, but I'm not. We only had 10 snow stakes, and I think it's a thankless. This was part of my Canadian experience. I got the idea in Canada, but it works quite differently in the tundra where everything's level. To dance at a place like Adelaide, which is very rocky, and there's no such thing as mean snow depth, or it's a complete guess.
So was the idea to try to measure the snow depth? Your
the idea was to do a daily measurement.
Is it something you instigated personally?
Yes, yes, it is, yes.
So, and...
I don't think it was had any particular meaning, except as an indication of a particularly snowy year.
So it was a not completely successful experiment?
I wouldn't have called it completely successful, yeah. No.
There's also reference to plans to do meteorological work in the northern end of Adelaide Island... But these were shelled because of the Argentinians. That puzzled me slightly.
Gosh.
That doesn't ring any bells.
They were shelved, as far as I remember, they were... Goodness. No, that's very puzzling. We had ideas of reporting, setting up a station and work. Reporting back, yes. I don't remember how the algaes came into that.
Okay, well, maybe I'll look over lunch and we'll come back to that. Yeah, okay. Look, you're also trying to measure the thickness of ice and had equal problems with that.
Sea ice. Mm. Yeah. Or the Piedmont ice.
Well, either.
Yes, we had a lot of trouble with the Piedmont ice at the north end of Adelaide Island. We'd come back after a few months and have difficulty locating the stakes, which some cases were completely disappeared. Quite extraordinary, the drift accumulation. The snow stake, the Piedmont snow stake experiment was completely off the record. It was something extra that we did, but part of the meteorological work was to do the daily reading, weekly daily reading of sea ice temperature and sea ice thickness off the coast of Adelaide.
Okay. And again, there's a reference to do with personnel problems at this time, I think. Problems with a chap called Dick Scotham.
Yes, he was the chap who was made BC, yes. For me, he was a good friend. There was nothing... I think he was particularly unfortunate in the... some of the people that year. He had a very difficult mob to control. I think that the troublemakers with the diesel mech and the radio operator and to a lesser extent the cook I think that was the real problem. I don't think it was Dick Scotham's. There were personnel problems in the winter of 1970, yes.
Mm. When you say troublemakers, what do you mean, Ken?
The diesel mech was... he was an older person anyway. He was a rough diamond and called a spade, but and for some reason he took an instant dislike to Dick Scotham, and we were only 10 winterers that year, 10 or 11 people wintering. It's a very small number to have three troublemakers, and talking against Dick the whole time, and the radio operator wasn't much better. He was.
Did you step in at all?
I didn't as much. I wish I should have done. I didn't step in. I tried to put Dick Scotham's what Dick was trying to do, and I thought he was well meaning, and yes.
The suggestion that you might have mediated at times between the
yes
the factions, is that true?
I suspect I did. Yes. I was the kind of a mediator. Yes.
What do you remember of that?
It was generally fairly unpleasant. And I tried not to let it get me down. I just carried on with my met work and kept sane that way. But
on a more practical note, you had to fly a guy, one of your Met colleagues at Fossil Bluff had to be evacuated.
Yes, that was an interesting episode, and it broke up our winter and was a great morale booster, that.
Tell me about that, Ken.
It was the most interesting episode. Bass appealed to the Argentine Air Force to rescue this guy. Well, they appealed through the Argentine consulate, and... they sent down this Pilatus Porter, I think, a tiny plane, with an air crew of three, apart from the pilot, air crew of two and the pilot. And they performed this remarkable double rescue operation at Fossil Bluff. There was the other guy who had something wrong with his stomach. I've forgotten if it was an ulcer, something, or maybe worse than an ulcer. But he had a stomach complaint and had to be flown out. And the diesel mech had broken his leg. I've forgotten the name of the pilot, but he was a good bloke, and the assistant pilot was a good bloke too. They spent quite a long time at Adelaide waiting for the right day, of course, and took part in all the base activities and lived as one of us, and they were a great help.
So they flew the rescue mission from
and
Adelaide.
They got a good day and flew. Yes, they flew from Adelaide, and absolutely hair-raising. But they were lucky with the weather, and we had a good day for the flight, and a good day to come back, even more important.
Did you go with them?
No, I didn't. No, they didn't take any of us. They were.
The plane was going to be full, wasn't it?
Yes, it was full. Yeah, yeah.
And you had to supply a replacement Metman to Fossil Bluff.
In the summer, yes. We didn't supply a winter one.
That was a separate incident, was it?
Yes, that was. We did regular shifts at Fossil Bluff. Each summer, Fossil Bluff, this was the first wintering team at Fossil Bluff, I think. And
no, not quite.
Not quite,
no,
yes.
No, they
right.
had been there before.
Right. Our job was, from when I remember it, was back in 64, was to do summer stints at Fossil Bluff on a shift basis as a relief, to supply met for the aircraft. So we did 3 weeks down there and then, depending on the weather, and then came back. But as far as this winter, nothing happened until the summer, until the planes came down.
What's your memories of Fossil Bluff in the early 70s?
Oh, a wonderful place, absolutely fabulous. The favourite of either Adelaide, Stonington or Fossil Bluff. Just four bunks round a living room, kitchen. The Met Office was one bunk, and a delightful place to. Not very interesting for a Met man, perhaps. That was the only thing. There was no weather there. It was just fine the whole time, and a bit of drift snow occasionally. Nothing seriously bad.
The tensions at Adelaide in that season, 71 season, do you think that
yes.
actually really affected the work of the base, or was it just something that was kept under control?
No, I don't think, yes, it didn't affect the work of the base. I think the diesel mech's work was affected by his home environment much more than by what went on base. No, I think it was a successful winter for the base work, I think, yes.
And the fact that you did try to be a peacemaker as such, is that why you think that another attempt was made to recruit you as a base commander later on?
Yes, I'm sure that came into it, yes, yes, yeah.
What are the outstanding memories do you have of those that second Adelaide Island tour?
The second was in the relief of 1970-71. We had a shocking relief.
How do you mean?
It was the Bransfield which came in then, and we had a prodigious swell, a real South Pacific swell that made the whole operation virtually untenable. I've never seen anything like it before or since. Something. About a 10-foot swell, probably more than that even, with the ship rolling around out in the anchorage and the scow with tremendous problems to tie up alongside the jetty because it was being lifted out of all proportion.
Well, this is a prolonged episode.
It didn't. It went on for one day as an extreme. The extreme conditions went on for one day. But it was quite. It was the congestion of ice around the jetty which made it a bad relief. Extremely difficult, and the combination of ice and swell. Yes. And it was quite dangerous. We nearly lost several people. One of the mates was nearly lost.
Was there any suggestion to actually pause in the work, so to wait for the swell to die down?
They were late. It was late in the season. They were very keen to get north as soon as possible, and I think Captain Lawrence. I think he might well have waited, but he didn't. And but
it was hair raising
from the base commander was Richie Hesbrook by that time, and it was a hair raising time for him. We lost quite a bit of the cargo, and the outgoing cargo and the incoming, which was serious. They just couldn't be retained in the nets. And jolly times, yes.
Did anybody actually work out why the swell was happening? Was it a tsunami or something? Or
No. It was a big gale, just not far away, close to Adelaide, relatively close, about 500 miles or 400 miles. Yes, and. And I think that relief was one of the factors which contributed to the move to Rothera later in the 70s.
Right, that people began to get suspicious of the conditions.
Yes, we were getting bad sea ice continually, bad sea ice in the winter, and then horrific seas in March, in particular February, March, Yes, that was one of the main reasons. The other reason being the breakup of the Piedmont ice.
So when you came back from that second spell at Adelaide, you came back to the UK again. What happened next? Where did you go after that? Because again, there's a gap in your
back past. Back to Canada, actually. Yes, yes. It was the Arctic Institute of North America's North Water Project. To find out the between Greenland and Canada, right up at the top end of Greenland, of Ellesmere Island, there's the North Water, an area which stays ice free despite air temperatures of -40, and they wanted to investigate this and find out why.
And did you?
Yesterday I was sent up as a met man again.
And did they find out why?
Upwelling of warm water is the reason. That came much later. I just went up as a met observer and did the three alley observations at Coburg Island.
Let's leave you in Canada for a take a break, and then we'll come back and talk some more.
Okay, great. Yes, yes.